just go. We'll leave that door open. My name's Paul, and it's probably strange to some of you to see a white guy, especially with a white guy with short hair, teaching African American literature. One brief, without going into the whole long story, one brief introduction of why a white guy with Norwegian background and grown up in Minnesota would ever be interested, intuitively began when before I even knew it, as a little kid living in a town that had a Native American reservation nearby. And I knew, but I could never articulate, that this was out of whack. And that these kids who were better basketball players than we white kids were didn't come out for basketball. And they didn't be in the plays and work on the yearbook or anything. And there was a segregation that was obvious and to me, again, not able to articulate it, kind of painful. Well, that was in my life since as a little kid. And then I was in grad school, done with a master's degree in American literature, with undergrad majors in American history and English, which would cover American and English literature. And my best friend in grad school was a black guy. We got to be friends because we played basketball instead of reading every day. And I was sitting beside him in a class in which a professor referred to Richard Wright. I'm going to back up for a second. I was done with a master's degree in English and I'm starting on a PhD. And I turned to him and, John, who's Richard Wright? I'd never heard of him. I had been at two major universities and a liberal arts college for a degree, and again, a master's degree, and I hadn't heard of Richard Wright. That's institutional racism. It's a canon that has been selected, probably unconsciously, maybe consciously, that says you need to know these folks, but you don't need to know these folks. And at that time, when the University of Oregon could afford or would allow, I guess, guest lecturers, I kind of stumbled, well, after that little episode, stumbled and chose to take two classes in African American literature, one taught by a very radical, this is in the 70s now, black poet named Elvin Hobert, and a very radical white teacher who became, and probably still is, the best literary critic on Richard Wright, John Riley. Riley taught fiction, and Hobert taught poetry, and short-haired blonde guy got changed forever. Okay. All that said, through the years, it's become what started out, I think, as an issue of justice and fairness has become an issue of awe, respect, and it sounds kind of hokey, but I'll illustrate it in a second, love for justice and for the people that write this stuff. Okay. Anybody have any questions about that crazy introduction? But you got to know, I think. I mean, what is a... guys, what? Okay. Here's what Richard Wright says. Richard Wright's the guy that wrote... Anybody know?
Native Son.
Black Boy. Popular books. Black Boy's Book of the Month Club back in 1945. Probably one of America's most... famous, but for sure important, fiction writers of the 20th century. Well, in one of his pieces of nonfiction, he says this. Is it not clear to you that the American Negro, we're using this, he's writing in 1957, this one. Is it not clear to you that the American Negro is the only group in our nation that consistently and passionately raises the question of freedom? Why would he even say that? Isn't it clear to you Black folk are the only group in our nation who consistently and passionately raise the question of freedom? We'll move on, but white people don't have to. And it's not an issue for the most part. And then in 12 Million Black Voices, another piece of nonfiction, Wright says this, what we want, what we represent, what we endure is what America is. If we black folk perish, America will perish, for we are you. Read some poems quickly. to get to a piece of fiction that I think suggests something about love and justice that you'll get in a second. Dudley Randall is a pretty modern poet, I think we'd say. Just a little poem. A critic advises not to write on controversial subjects like freedom or murder, but to treat universal themes and timeless symbols like the white unicorn. We gotta get that fly.
I know, there's two there's some
sorry. Five mosquitoes in
here.
It's right
at the
corner. I
would
be killing them,
yeah.
I wouldn't get any
news. And there's bats and bears and jerkins. I'll run by this and run this by again. A critic advises not to write on controversial subjects like freedom or murder, but to treat universal themes and timeless symbols like the white unicorn. A white unicorn? Literature has taken, and those of you who heard in Verlon and Peter's sessions in the last 3 days, white privilege. Literature and the canon have surely exacerbated that situation of white privilege. We'll keep going, and this will come together, and we'll have a chance to discuss our responses to this, too, and reactions. The forerunners. America, it is to thee, thou boasted land of liberty, it is to thee I raise my song, thou land of blood and crime and wrong. It is to thee, my native land, from which has issued many a band to tear the black man from his soil, and force him here to delve and toil. Chained on your blood-be-moistened sod, cringing beneath a tyrant's rod, stripped of those rights which nature's God bequeathed to all the human race, bound to a petty tyrant's nod because he wears a paler face. I'm just going to keep going. Folk seculars are poems that sometimes don't even have. We don't even know who wrote them. Passed on orally. This is written in dialect. My old mistress promised me when she died she'd set me free. She lived so long that her head got bald, and she'd given up the notion of dying at all. My old mistress said to me, Sambo, I was going to set you free, but when that head gets slick and bald, the Lord couldn't have killed her with a big green maul. I hope there's some humor in this, but my old mistress never died. With her nose all hooked and her skin all dry, but my old miss, she's somehow gone. She left Uncle Sambo a hillin' up corn and didn't get free. I mean, she promised, but it didn't happen. Old Mosser likewise promised me when he died he'd set me free. But old Mosser go and make his will for to leave me a plowin' old Beck still. Yes, my old Mosser promised me, but his papers didn't leave me free. A dose of poison kept him along. Maybe the devil preached his funeral song. You get it, he killed him. Okay. And one more. I tell you how that hypocrite do. He come down to my house and talk about you. He talk about me and he talk about you, and that's the way that hypocrite do. I tell you how that hypocrite pray. He pray out loud in a hypocrite way. He pray out loud, got a heap to say. And that's the way the hypocrite pray. I tell you how that hypocrite tend. He tend that and he love and he tend, pretend. I tell you how that hypocrite tend. He tend that he love and then he don't love men. And he tend that he love and he hate prayer men. And that's the way that hypocrite lives. We're going to get to some stuff that's different. Any responses to that I've read fast on purpose? Old poems. These aren't the kind that are going to get anthologized in the book of great African-American poetry. It's going to get covered as just to cover something genealogical. Here's a different one. You might have heard, if you were around or read about World War II, this was made famous in the Shirley at the time. A guy named Claude McKay wrote it. They didn't acknowledge that Claude McKay, a black poet, wrote it. And this is the poem that Churchill read after the bombings of London. If we must die, let it not be like hogs hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot. If we must die, well, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. The far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. You heard, anybody ever heard that? It's this Churchill thing. No one's going to claim that this is great poetry yet. We're going to get some. Any responses to this? What I wanted to do was try to illustrate this notion to you. Here's Wright. Is it not clear to you that the American Negro is the only group in our nation that consistently and passionately raises the question of freedom? Do you sense that in any of those poems? And how so, if you do?
Well, I sensed it in that poem about the, when you were reading in the vernacular. You know, it was like, here this guy could barely speak the language, but he was desperate to be free. You know, relying on these people who, you know, weren't going to set him free. He doesn't know what those papers say.
Yeah, good. And it sure is a consciousness raiser for those of us here in the 21st century. But we got to know that the slaves, too, I mean, and the poets are raising this consciousness right away. I mean, we know about abolition movements, and we know about people speaking out against slavery for hundreds of years. I think part of the point is, without this voice, America's a pretty good place. I mean, we had a forum here 3 weeks ago on patriotism, and as soon as we know right now, currently, that the difficulty in being unpatriotic, you know, you criticize the government at all. Well, if the government isn't criticized, who's going to do it? Who's going to talk about the war? Who's going to talk about injustice? Well, here's some a little bit more modern, and I think what one would call better poetry. You know, I say better poetry. I'm going to read in a second a poem that the stuff I grew up on with white privilege and the white normative. You read guys like Samuel Johnson and Samuel Coleridge and Percy Bysshe Shelley who say this is the definition of poetry. Well, they've got a prism, a lens through which they look to decide this is what poetry is, and if it's not this, it can't be good poetry. Well, maybe I'll skip to that one and then come back. This is what they would say, that this is not good poetry, but I'll let you decide. This is written by a guy named Don L. Lee, since changed his name. He teaches at the University of Chicago, and it's called Communication in Whitey. And he wrote it at the time of the Vietnam War when the North Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese, America, and France were trying to negotiate their way through, diplomatically through, to get out of this war. Does anybody remember when that all started, what the biggest issue was? The shape of the table. And that went on for 6 months. And they decided, you know, we have a T shape, an L shape. So they finally decided on a round table. But it took them 6 months to do that, and a lot of people kept track of how many people, civilians and military people, were killed during that time. Well, is this a poem? And who speaks out? Again, here's Wright, way back in the 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, early 60s, saying, somebody has to listen. Well, here's Don L. Lee. I'm going to read it. I've heard him read it. Some try to read it like he did. The Paris Peace Talks, 1968. Is that a poem? It's interesting, that's for sure. Is it? But here I hear right again. Is it not clear to you that we're the only group in our nation consistently and passionately raising the question of freedom? Who's the speaker? I think if they were using biblical terms, and I'm going to compose my own thoughts on that, the poets are the prophets. It's the.
So, what is he saying? Like, what is that supposed to be emulating?
What did you feel? You know, that's a great question because it leads us to this, I think, complex thing about all art, especially in we got in here, poetry and fiction. It's not only about something, it is an experience itself. So when you get just this nonsense, crazy words, what did you experience? And you got to be honest with that. Oh, shut up. Well, I don't know what you felt. What did you
feel? It was silly. It was silly.
It's a, and therefore, here's Peace Talks, 1968.
It's something like all of the, you know, the news flash stuff that would come on before, you know, all the things that would go before anything happened on the news, all the, now it's all graphic generated.
All those sounds.
All those things, and then they deliver nothing.
That's very good. And I never thought of that. I can surely imagine Don Elliott having that in mind, even, whether he did or didn't. We got that. That's great. And it's silly. What else is it? Logical? Sensible? Does it have an order?
I thought you were doing Morse code at first.
Yeah. You don't know what he's doing, right?
Yeah.
And so listen to the words that you say, the way you describe your response to the poem, and then just, it all becomes a lifelike active metaphor for Paris Peace Talks. What is it? It delivers nothing. 6 months, and in that time 150,000 people die.
None of the words made sense to anybody else. I mean, if you're simulating the words or the noise of the word or the conversation, nothing makes sense.
Nothing makes sense.
Hear it, but there's constant sound. No communication.
It's full of sound and fury that signifies nothing.
Yeah.
Well, a couple more. And then we'll move off into something that I think, let's see. This is Langston Hughes. He's very famous for poetry, for being a real leader in the Harlem Renaissance and raising black consciousness in art. Leading the way in art and in the as well as political action too, in the 1920s and 30s. There are words like freedom, sweet and wonderful to say on my heartstrings. Freedom sings all day, every day. There are words like liberty that almost make me cry. If you had known what I know, you'd know why. Just quickly, a thought. There are words like freedom, sweet and wonderful to say. And one of the things we have to ask if we're going to make, there are some categories, some prisons worth looking through that are constant. One of them perhaps is, can a poem mean something in 1920 and still mean something 80 years later? There are words like freedom, sweet and wonderful to say.
What that poem said to me is, if you haven't walked my boots, you don't know what it's like.
Yeah. And good. If you had known what I know, you'd know why I ask the questions. Is it not clear to you that the only voice, the prophets? One more, and then I'm going to change gears. It's interesting, too, that a black poet from Harlem would know, we think they don't, would know the whole world situation. Durban, where is it? South Africa. And, of course, Cape Town. Johannesburg, Durban, Birmingham, Cape Town, Atlanta, Johannesburg, Watts. The earth around, struggling, fighting, dying. For what? A world to gain. Groping, hoping, waiting. For what? A world to gain. Dreams kicked asunder, why not go under? There's a world to gain. But suppose I don't want it. Why take it? To remake it. I think we got to look at this just for a second. It was John Riley, that white critic, who said the only approach a white man can take to African-American literature is a radical one. The radical vision simply means, you guys talked about it for an hour here just a little while ago, the radical vision to undo the whole sense of how we read the Bible, the whole sense of white, what you've been talking about for 3 days. Listen to a piece of fiction about, it's a wonderful little book, not without laughter. It's a coming out of innocence story of a little boy named Sandy. And I'll read some episodes and you'll get... I'll just to clarify this, I'll do this. We've got Hagar in this book, and that's Grandma. We have Sandy, and he's the hero, the protagonist. And we have Willie May later. And we have Earl. Earl is white. And we have Harriet. Hagar is the grandmother. He's the main character. He's the guy that is the catcher in the rye story. Hagar is his grandmother. Harriet is his aunt. And his aunt, though, is young. She's 16 years old. And this is episode number one. A few weeks ago, Harriet had gone with her classmates on tickets issued by the school to see an educational film of the undersea world at the Palace Theater on Main Street. It was a special performance given for the students, and each class had had seats allotted to them beforehand. So Harriet sat with her class and had begun to enjoy immensely the strange wonders of the ocean depths when an usher touched her on the shoulder. "The last three rows on the left are for colored," the girl in the uniform said. But I'm with my class," Harriet stammered. "We're all supposed to sit here." "I can't help it," insisted the usher, pointing towards the rear of the theater, while her voice carried everywhere. "Them's the house rules. No argument now. You'll have to move." So Harriet rose and stumbled up the dark aisle and out into the sunlight, her slender body hot with embarrassment and rage. The teacher saw her leave the theater without a word of protest, and none of her white classmates defended her for being black. They didn't care. "All white people are alike, in school and out," Harriet concluded bitterly, as she told of her experiences to the folks sitting with her on the porch in the dark. There's lots of real obvious there, but what else is, say the obvious too, it's discrimination, it's segregation. What else do you see? And we're going to look at this. Are you not aware that they're the only people talking about freedom? The Harriet episode.
I see Verlaine's overseers and the teacher and the...
It's a great tie-in. And I heard somebody, I don't know if it was Jeannie, saying that the overseers are the people who perpetuate the status quo. Even, and they don't have to have a deliberate kind of power, but they contribute to that structure, and they oversee that we'll keep all things intact. The teacher doesn't say a word. Her classmates don't say a word. They might even have been friends. Good. That's a great comment. Anything else? I'm going to push you a little bit then. And what? Because it's easier in fiction. This, I think, has become a longer book, and characters are developed. What personal response do you make? A connection do you make to this character? I mean, here's Harriet. She's 16 years old, and if you read the first the first 90 pages, you'd know Harriet a little better. But you don't have to know her very well. So just what do you say or feel? But I'm supposed to. We're all supposed to sit here.
Well, you feel bad for her.
For sure.
I mean, you kind of.
I hope so. I mean, I think that's what a writer is after.
Yeah.
So we empathize.
Yeah. But then she kind of turns it, and she sort of does the same thing by saying all people, all white people are all the same.
Yeah. And what's her experience? I mean, in the whole novel, is that's her experience. That is white people. You can maybe all wonder, how does a white guy last 35 years teaching African-American literature to black students. I just assume that lots of kids have had throughout their life not a lot of reasons to trust white people. Simply some white guy with short hair again and is blonde walks in and says, "I'm going to teach African-American literature." Well, who the hell are you? What can you do? So we can begin to understand, and maybe it's a great lesson for white folks too, that the perspective of why wouldn't she conclude that? What has the white structure done to make her say, "Oh, that dirty rotten usher, it was just, I won't take it personally, it's just this one person." Well,
nobody stood up for her.
Nobody stood up for her, right? And part of it is we all participate in this overseer role. So to all of a sudden find an exception by an individual black character, why would that happen? So for sure, Sandy, in his growth out of innocence into experience, as William Blake would put it, the 19th century English poet, this whole movement of all humankind, for sure Sandy's going to have some kind of experience that's going to make him not generalize the way Harriet has. And we'll see in the novel, you know, just how that works. Okay, but we're going to get more, I think, complicated, as Hughes does. Now, Sandy is 10 years old. Harriet's about 16. Where's Sandy? He's 10. And then it's his first time now in an integrated school. It's the fifth grade.
Yeah, did you tell us when this was written?
1934. And that's I'm glad you asked that, because we're going to say, it's pretty easy to say, well, this is 70 years ago. Right. And we don't live in the same situation. Or do we? And we'll see. And because it's about social justice, and it's also about psychological, philosophical consciousness, too. We'll see that, I think. Well, Sandy goes to school. First day of class. His teacher begins. "Take seats, all of you, please," she rasped out. "Anywhere now till we get order." She rapped again impatiently with the ruler. "Take seats at once." So the children each selected a desk and sat down, most of the girls at the front of the room, and most of the boys together at the back, where they could play and look out the windows. Then the teacher, middle-aged, I don't teach this novel very often, but when I do, I always ask students. I thought of that when you said that today, too. Now, what's middle-aged? Be very careful as you answer that. I have him up to 75 now. The teacher, middle-aged and wearing glasses, passed out tiny slips of paper to each child in the front row with a command that they be handed backwards so that every student received one slip. "Now, write your names on the paper, turning it long ways, and nothing but your names, that's all I want today." Amid much confusion and borrowing of pencils, the slips were finally signed in big awkward letters, and she gets them handed in. I'm skipping some. "Now," she said, "each child rise as I call out your name so I can see who you are." The teacher stood up with the papers in her hand. "Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich, Josephine Evans," she called, slowly glancing up after each name. "Franklin Rhodes, James Rogers," that's the real name of our nickname, Sandy, he's James Rogers. "James Rogers," Sandy stood up quickly. "Ethel Shortledge, Roland Thomas," the roll call continued. Each child standing until he had been identified, then sitting down again. "Now," the teacher said, "everybody rise and make a line around the walls. Quietly, no talking, as I call your names this time, take seats in order, starting with number one in the first row near the window. Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich," the roll was repeated, each child taking a seat as she had commanded. When all but four of the children were seated, the two colored girls and Sandy still were standing. "Albert Zwick," she said, and the last white child sat down in his place. "Now," said the teacher, "you three children, there, take seats behind Albert. You girls take the first two, and you," pointing to Sandy, "take the last one. Now I'm putting on the board the list of books to buy now, and I want all of you to copy them correctly." And she went on with her details of schoolroom routine. Any thoughts? Again, the obvious is it's discrimination. That's cruel. But go further. Let the experience that we just watched Sandy go through work into both our minds and our, we had this word up here, our empathy too.
He didn't even have names.
It's so much more names. And that fits some of the things that we heard just the last hour. We're going to hear more in the next 2 days, too, about who gets named and how important is it to be named. And so Sandy, this 10-year-old kid, goes to the back of the room. No name. Good. Anything else?
We see this still happening with young women in elementary school classrooms. That they're being spoken to less, taught less, directed comments to us than male students.
Yeah. I love that kind of comment, to take a book written in 1934 and you can say we still see. So good literature has something that says about human nature and human experience that is universal, that isn't just then there. And one of the things that we begin to learn about, I guess, all literature, or through all literature, is that here's a slave narrative. Is that about there, then? Does this happen there in Mississippi to those people? Or is there something about that whole structure, institutionally, attitudinally, that is bigger than just there and then? And now we have it with little girls today. Good. Anything else?
Part of it is just striking that we tend to think of 54 as the benchmark for integrated classrooms. This is, I'm assuming, memories are based on Missouri, Lankton Hughes from Missouri, right?
Yep.
Missouri schools, where they were, the school districts simply brought the schools together, where they, the kids together, where they, and the formula was least expensive.
Yeah.
But with the black kids at the back, so that, I kind of make me wonder what happened in 1954.
Ron Brown, yeah.
What really changed?
Yeah, so here's, this is pre 54, and then 54 comes, Brown versus Board of Education, segregation is illegal. And what has really happened?
I think why even bother to segregate? If you're going to treat them like that, why not just stay segregated? I mean, you know, why bother to integrate if you're going to treat them like that? Just stay segregated and let, you know, yep, let them be people with their own people.
Yeah, good. My favorite coach.
Well, I think some of the things that happened to all of us are inherent in what our experiences have been.
Yeah.
I've never lived in a town where there were any black people. And I went to Oregon to graduate school. And we had a, when this particular thing happened, we had a three-year-old daughter. And we went to a movie in Eugene. And she leaned up in front of her mother who was holding her and said, "Mommy, there's a Chinaman back there." And it was a black person. She'd never seen a black person. And sometimes I think in where you grow up and the attitude you hear at home stay with you till you're confronted with it. And I think of how naive I was when I went to Cal. And one of my kids came up to me one morning in a plaza and said, "Coach, Martin Luther King got killed today." I didn't know who Martin Luther King was. I never been confronted with that issue. After that, things changed for me. But a lot of times, I think what we see is lack of exposure. Nobody has challenged the status quo.
And what's sad about that story, kind of going along with the lines that, is things may have changed in 54, the desegregation, but you can't change immediately the hearts, minds, and perspectives and empathy of people. So the teacher may have had to follow, this is long before that, but you just can't immediately change people without experience.
Yeah.
They still have their prejudice.
Yeah. Well, great story. Thank you. And in the sense of what that story is, I wrote these words up here. What leads the way? Attitudinal racism leads us into creating institutions. Well, they overlap and they work back and forth, don't they? Or institutional racism perpetuates attitudinal racism. The guy who said, who's Martin Luther King? The guy who said, educated. Again, master's degree, working on it, heading toward a PhD. Who's Richard Wright? Do they create my attitude that says, I really think that Ernest Hemingway is a great writer, and I can go on with all the dead white guys, right? They're really great. And what comes first? And so now we take that, and you've gotten that out of this little episode here. What comes first? This teacher, how old is she? She's middle-aged. Should she know better? I don't know. At what point?
Not if she's 75.
Not if she's 75. She's forgotten.
Hey, that's right. Middle-aged.
I like it, though. I'm getting closer. Well, let's keep going. There's one more important scene. There are lots of important scenes in this, but to set up this notion that we're on, and then I think I tried to tie together what you guys are doing in your sessions. This is near the end of the book, and our next characters, Sandy and Willie Mae and Earl, are all good friends in their community. In school, you saw that would be segregated, or separated at least. And there's a carnival that's coming to town. And the kids have been reading in the newspapers, and it goes on for about 10 pages before the scene I'm going to read to you. The neighbors are bringing newspapers over, and because the kids could cut out coupons, and every coupon they cut out means a free ride or more candy and so on. So my point is it's a big deal. It's 10 pages worth of big deal. In fact, you'll just hear a little bit of kind of oblique reference to Willie Mae. It's such a big deal to her, she puts on her best shoes and redresses up to go to the carnival, because the point is, this is a big deal, there's great anticipation, and here goes the scene. It was a long walk to the park, and Willie Mae stopped and took off her shoes and stockings, they must have been tight, you know, not comfortable, and carried them in her hands until she got near the gate. Then she put them on again and limped bravely along, clutching her precious bits of newspaper, those coupons. They could hear the band playing and children shouting and squealing as the cars and the shoot-the-shoots, that dates the book, doesn't it? Down into the water. Shot down and splashed into the pond. They could see the giant Ferris wheel, larger than the one the fair had had, circling high in the air. "I'm going to ride on that first," said Sandy. These kids are 10. There were crowds of children under the bright red and white wooden shelter at the park entrance. They were lining up at the gate, laughing, merry, clean little white children, pushing and yelling and giggling amiably. Sandy let Willie Mae go first, and he got in line behind her. The band was playing gaily inside. They were almost to the entrance now. There were just two boys in front of them. Willie Mae held out her black little hand, clutching the coupon as they moved forward. The man looked down. "Sorry," he said. "This party's for white kids." Willie Mae, they're 10. Willie Mae did not understand. She stood holding out the coupons, just waiting for the tall white man to take them. "Stand back, you two," he said, not unkindly. Looking at Sandy as well, "I told you, little darkies, this wasn't your party. Come on now, next little girl." And the line of white children pushed past Willie Mae and Sandy going into the park. Stunned, the two dark ones drew aside. Then they noticed a group of a dozen or more other colored youngsters, again, 1934, and that's what we've got, Negro colored, standing apart in the sun, just without the bright entrance pavilion, and among them was Sadie Butler, Sandy's classmate. Three or four of the colored children were crying, but most of them looked sullen and angry, and some of them had turned to go home. Remember every word you can, sullen, angry, sad, confused. "My papa takes the leader," Sandy Butler was saying. "And you see what it says here on the coupons, too. Free admittance to every child in Stanton. Can't you read it, Sandy?" "Sure, I can read it. But I guess it isn't being colored. They just won't let us in." Willie Mae, between the painful shoes and the hurt of her disappointment, was on the verge of tears. One of the small boys in the crowd, a hard-looking little fellow from Pearl Street, was cursing childishly. "God damn those sons of biscuit eaters, that's what they are. I wish I was a big man, doggone it. I'd shoot them all, that's what I'd do." "I just suppose they didn't mean black kids," said Sandy. "Well, Buster went in. I seen him. But they didn't know he was colored, I guess. When I went up to the gate, the man said, 'Whoa, where are you going?' Just like I was a horse. I'm going home now to tell my papa." Think about that. She walked away, followed by five or six other little girls in their Sunday dresses. Willie Mae was sitting on the ground, taking off her shoes again, sweat and tears running down her black cheeks. Sandy saw his white schoolmate, Earl, approaching. "What's the matter, Sandy? Ain't you going in?" Earl asked, looking at his friend's face. "Did Willie Mae hurt her foot?"
"No, we just ain't going in. Here, Earl, you can have my coupons. If you have extra ones, the paper says you get more lemonade. So you take them."
The white boy, puzzled, accepted the offered coupons, stood dumbly for a moment wondering what to say to his brown friend, then went on into the park. What do you have there?
I thought of Martin Luther King. And one of his speeches, I can't remember, he talks about his kids going to Happy Town. Or
Letter from Birmingham Jail.
Is that?
What do you tell your child when he's as close to Fun Town and what he's just seen on TV?
Yeah.
So we sure feel for the little kids. They're 10. They are kids. They are innocent.
I thought it was interesting that, I forget, was it Sandy talking at the end? He was trying to protect Earl.
Yeah.
He didn't even want to tell him why.
Yeah. So I'll write that down. And protect Earl. He's his friend.
What else do you think he's doing with Earl? Remember, these kids are 10. Sit down, Earl.
Yeah,
I
want
to tell you.
Huh? He gave his tickets to Earl.
Yeah. That's what you're supposed to do. That's great. Come here and have a good time. And you're my friend, and I'm going to have a good time.
It's also saving face.
For sure. So he's protecting Earl. There is...
How can Earl be so unaware? I mean, I know... Sorry, you guys. Like, they live in the same place.
Because whiteness is normed.
And so he knows? Earl knows this?
No. I mean, when it's normed, it becomes invisible. It's like...
Yes, and then even if it's his friend.
Yeah. And it's like the same thing you see with men and women.
Yeah.
Men just don't get it because men don't have to.
I'll never forget walking home every day for 5 years from grade school, 6 years, with three friends, all of whom were girls. Virginia, Karen, and Karen. We walked home together, and then just as we split off to go to our houses, and we also played softball on Saturdays and whenever we could. Virginia was the best. She was the fastest. And then came seventh grade, and I didn't walk home with them anymore because I was going off for football. This is a long time ago. But it dawned on me then, I think, again, intuitively, I just never could ever articulate it or even probably thought about it much. I'm thinking, I'm like Earl. My three really good friends, one of whom was a very good athlete, went off home, and I turned around and went back to football practice. There was no options for women.
Pre-Title IX.
Yeah, pre-Title IX, for sure. I'm not really that old. But I didn't get it either, and Earl isn't either. And what do you do with Earl? Sit down, Earl. Let me tell you about racism. Sit down, Earl. Let me tell you about segregation. Sit down, Earl. Let me give you a history of the whole legacy of what slavery is. Earl isn't going to get that.
Well, that's no different than today, like, you know, part of the pain of living with white people is that you're with them, and they get the good jobs, you know, they get into an apartment, these wonderful apartments or homes or whatever.
Or the condo.
Yeah. And you're still struggling, you know, trying to make it. And then part of the pain is trying to stay their friend, you know, when they just got so much more. And at some point, you want to just pull away and just say, forget it, you know. And some white friends, you know, often they just don't get it. They keep inviting you, they keep saying, let's go here, let's go there, let's do that. And yet they got so much more.
Some of my best friends are black. Yeah, too, right? And there we get into this whole notion of institutional and attitudinal. Well, Earl isn't a racist yet. Or a bigot, at least. I mean, for sure he isn't. But what happens when this... I love the world, that this is the norm. This is the status quo. And Sam's idea, there's no consciousness in Earl. Well, let's run back for a second. We got one more thing to do with this episode. Okay, Earl's 10. In fact, I'm going to graph this. Never done this before. We're going to... take it with kids. Earl is 10. How old is the gatekeeper at the? We don't know. It doesn't say.
30.
25, 30.
Okay, 25, 30. The gate. Man. And how old is the teacher?
40.
Yeah, 40 plus. No, I don't like that. 70. I do like that. Okay, when you put it on a graph, just ask, okay, and boy, don't we all identify with Sam's role of consciousness, if we're white, we do, identify with Sam's consciousness, his own rise in consciousness. I don't know who Martin Luther King is, but I know that man's legacy as a coach. His life changes. At what point along here do we expect people to be conscious? At what point is it time to say, okay, Earl, you're 10, but... you've got the gate. And he had some options, didn't he? He probably was aware of them because this is the norm. This is the way, this is life in the United States.
Well, they said he wasn't unkind.
He wasn't unkind.
So that,
but he's the overseer.
So that
great.
Took some, yes.
All these guys get good.
So that took some consciousness. if he wasn't unkind.
Yeah. But exactly. He's kind. But he.
I don't think necessarily so. That you don't have to be unkind. You don't have to be a bigot to be unkind. You don't have to be conscious of what's going on to be kind. If you live in a system in which it's normal for me to have things and you not to.
No.
It's not, it's not your turn. And that's normal, and you can deal with it.
Well, I'm not saying that he was right.
Right.
I'm just saying that you said he had options. He could have been an asshole. But he chose, you know.
Or he could have been an asshole. Draw that graph from an ass to unkind, even worse, to kind. What's the next step? Now we're going toward kind of away from whatever the opposite of being an ass would be. Are you following me?
Well, maybe he could have been countercultural.
There you go.
For him to let them in, he would have to be willing to break the rules.
I quit.
He knew the rules.
Yep. He could quit. Now, he isn't going to do that, but he could. What else could he do?
Hey, if you go around back.
There are some options.
Yeah.
But part of his consciousness, it's the norm, that doesn't even cross his mind. Any more than it crossed the mind of my English teachers all through undergrad and all through the master's degree program to say, you know what, Paul, you ought to read Richard Wright. He's really pretty good. And if you want to understand the depression, you can read Grapes of Wrath, right? John Steinbeck, or maybe you'll understand it in a very different way if you read Native Son. But it didn't even cross their mind. I don't know if anyone was sitting up in the English department offices saying, make sure those guys don't read Richard Wright, Zora Neale Hurston, and on. But again, it's Sam's phrase of, if not exposed, what kind of consciousness are we part of? And then I guess this is the everlasting question. At what point? And who is responsible for teaching this guy?
Well, I think the problem is that the institutional attitude or institutional racism never assumes the responsibility. It assumes that no one ever has to get there. Whereas if you put the black characters on there, they would all have that consciousness at about 8 years old.
I just thought of an American practice during World War II, and it's accounted for in a book called The Precarious Mission by Peter Berger. When Americans used the firing squad to kill traitors, they had seven guys line up, and you know the story, six of them had bullets. Somebody had a blank.
Mm.
So I could go home not thinking, feeling that I didn't kill traitors. I didn't kill anybody. And the institution was structured to diminish responsibility, to negate responsibility. Well, anything else? You're on to this, really, in the best of and most complicated ways. Is there anything else you see in these three episodes coming together?
You know, I think, Paul, one thing that happens is not just in racial issues, but in almost all of life, religion, whatever, children are a reflection of their parents' attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And if parents aren't aware, and they don't create an awareness in children, the children eventually have to face the issue as they come up against it.
All right, this is well said. Status quo is self-perpetuating. No wonder John Riley, the white critic, said the only approach a white man can take to black literature is radical. To somehow interrupt this status quo that the parents or the institutions or whatever it is that have been having forever. Yeah.
I was thinking when you mentioned the day Martin Luther King was shot, I was involved in a project in Chicago where students from a very white, very racist, very blue collar suburb.
Luana.
Oakland. We were sent as interns into this school, and we were engaged in a project whereby they wrote essays in the suburban school on family, home, politics, future, religion. And it was modeled after a book where two boys wrote on these five issues and exchanged information. And then they wrote to people in Hyde Park, at the Hyde Park Junior High School. And, you know, I'm thinking that was 1967. We were sent into the school, so the university protected us. The principal knew what was going on. And we said it was so because students write better when they write for their peers than for a teacher. So they do essays. If their peers were reading them, the writing would improve. And that was all a ruse because we wanted to change perception. You know, the outcome. But no one in Oak Lawn deduced after three exchange of essays that they were writing to other than ones just like themselves. Utterly astonishing. And I sat there elsewhere in Chicago, and we were waiting at what point, because we were sort of feeling our way. And it was the day that Martin Luther King was shot that I said, the people you, because they said, raise the flag 10 feet. It was awful. And I said that day, these are the five essays that we're doing are being exchanged with students who are in mourning today. And then there was a whole other dimension to the, needless to say, to the exchanges. Eventually the kids met, not before the kids in my school, Juan called and said, you're not having any of my kids go down to the city, I'm not prejudiced, but none of my kids are going down to visit the kids in the Hyde Park area. Well, in 1967, I mean, in retrospect, I think, how does change take place? Like, eventually, two from Oak Lawn came to visit a half dozen from Hyde Park. And the rest of you are forbidden and not interested. I mean, how does change take place? Everybody's got an answer, a proposal, or a cynicism. I don't know. I mean, all of you have a story of intervention or hope. At the time, I think I had great hope that this project would expand and widen. The kids would learn to know each other before they knew each other's race. And it was a precarious moment that could never probably have been repeated.
I'm just going to try out of Verlaine's discussion yesterday. Hire a black director. Put somebody black on the school board. Status quo is self-perpetuating. It requires vision and radical action. And I'm going back to 1940, the way this whole thing started. Is it not clear to you that the American Negro is the only group in our nation consistently and passionately raising the question of freedom? Who do we listen to? And who are the prophets and the poets? I once had a black mother ask me, how do you teach this stuff? It's so depressing. I had a response for it then, and I share it still with students. There's two responses. One is going to be here in the story itself, we'll hear in a second. And the other is, I think that the very act of creating art is affirmative. If a writer, Richard Wright, as radical as he thought, and as visionary as he was, and as angry as he was against white institutions, I mean, this guy expatriated himself to France because he just could not tolerate it anymore. As radical as he was, would say that my writing is to affirm life. If I didn't believe that we could change, why would I bother to write the book? Well, there's another. That's one answer, and it's more complicated than I just explained. But here's another one, and it comes from like one character we haven't talked about yet. Grandma. Sandy goes home, and I can do this in the 2 minutes that are there. Sandy goes home. And there's another character I didn't write on the board, Sister Johnson, who lived in a community, and her story is told earlier, who lived in a community that was very, a black community that was very, very successful, and they had painted houses, and they were buying cars, and the white people came in and destroyed it, because it's much too successful, and there's a history of that throughout America. Sister Johnson was there, too. When Willie Mae and Sandy got home and told her story, Sister Johnson was angry as a wet hand. Crackers as devils, she said. I expected as much. They ain't nearly hot enough to burn all white folks, because they're devils themselves, the dirty hounds. But all Hager, I mean, there's anger, and it's justifiable, we all understand. But all Hager said was, they's po' trash that owns that park, but don't know no better and hurting children's feelings, but we'll forgive them. Don't fret yourself, Sister Johnson. What good can fretting do? Come on here, let's we have a party of our own. And she went out in the yard and took a watermelon from a tub of well water where it had been cooling and cut it into four juicy slices. Then they sat down in the grass at the shady side of the house and ate, trying to forget about white folks. It's surely a legitimate question. Is this just some kind of an Uncle Tom or a Aunt Jemima woman that says, we're not going to bother, we're not going to fight them?
Or is, and that's a question you answered. Or is, does grandma have some notion that I'm not going to let my grandson's existential self be defined by somebody else? And I think Langston Hughes is deliberate choosing what do they eat?
Water.
And what is it becoming? That's kind of the quintessential soul food in American myths, isn't it? And we're going to sit down and eat this water now. And never, it's not like we're going to forget it. We're going to forgive him. And you can talk about that. This is this mealy-mouthed old Christian woman who's just going to give up and be kind, and I'll take my eternal life and be the good thing. Or is it some woman who's got a sense, come on, Sammy, this is who you are, and we're going to celebrate that at the party. Go ahead.
I think the fact that her name is Hagar is much, very meaningful. This is the expelled African
Before Abraham, yeah.
Who receives a promise before Sarah does, has a theophany, before anybody, any woman in the Bible,
yeah.
Who sets off a whole different line of promise to her child.
Yeah. And Langston Hughes would know that. He's an educated, smart guy. Well, we have a good vision, and the fun part of all this is that it affirms, I guess, our questions about status quo. It affirms our questions about what kind of prophetic vision poets provide for us. Thank you. See you whenever.
You're not going to get it regardless how much you swing that thing.
You're going to hit them all day, huh?
To Wright's affirmation of life. What do you think of Nell Larson's stuff? She goes, two books.
Yeah.
Very complex, very painful, and then she disappeared.
I don't know. A lot of writers at her time disappeared. One of hers is passed.